Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair OnFit. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Daniel Tenengauser, Head of Market Strategy and Insights at Bank of New York Mellon. In this capacity, Daniel leads strategy for BNY Mellon Markets, particularly offering views on global asset and currency flows. He has more than 20 years of cross-asset experience as a global macro researcher and has worked previously at many of the world's leading financial institutions as a senior strategist. Welcome, Danny.
Hi, thank you for having me, Mark.
Good. Well, let's dig in. So let's start with the very big picture that will help shape global asset markets and currency flows. So how do you see the global economy in 2021? The general view is that China's in a V-shaped recovery. The U.S. can expect a big second half as vaccine rollout builds confidence, complemented by a highly accommodative Fed and big fiscal support. Europe and Japan are seen as having less forceful policy responses and lagging. Do you buy that worldview, and do you see more downside or upside risks?
Well, I mean, let me actually backtrack a little bit when I look into the flows and the view. So first of all, I mean, the short answer to your question is I do believe that we are in a gradual secular trend of rotations, a rotation out of a U.S. leadership when it comes to both asset classes, bonds and equities, towards a more international portfolio. Okay. So, and this is probably again, it's secular, right? It's a multi-year story that obviously will have bumps along the road. And we saw very clearly that panning out right after the U.S. presidential elections. So November, actually heading into it, so late October, most of November, and then into early December, we saw very clearly, first of all, the U.S. bond market was the least desired when it comes to flows, and people selling U.S. treasuries and essentially buying pretty much every single other market out there, with the top contenders being actually China, Canada, and the Eurozone. When it comes to equities, the flows in and out of the U.S. were more or less neutral, a slight buying, but also a very clear demand for emerging markets and also the U.K., interestingly enough, and that was obviously a Brexit trade, right? So the question is, okay, is this a temporary thing or not? And in our view, it's not. This is something that will go on for quite some time, primarily because a negative real yields in the U.S. are incredibly deep, right? So you have very negative rates in the U.S. We do believe that there is a fairly large number of markets that are attractive. And again, just look at yields in China, for instance, and so on and so forth. So we do believe this trend is actually going to hold for quite some time going forward.
That is an interesting observation. Obviously, even if you're right, there are going to be big ups and downs along the path that will offer plenty of opportunities to you. I've written that I think the European and Japanese recoveries are going to be less dynamic than America's. And I think China still has capital controls and is trying to restrain leverage. So I perhaps see it a little more nuanced and balanced as you're offering. But we shall see. That's what keeps things interesting. Let me follow up a little bit then on the U.S. I find that there's general optimism about the U.S. economy for later this year, but the extent of that optimism depends on the vaccine rollout, and fiscal support will obviously play into that. One economist I know felt that the economy, if confidence returns somewhat quickly, could be well over 6% this year. Another thought it would return in the second half, but it would be in the 5% camp. But you know, we're not off to a smooth start on vaccinations, but as I said, I do expect a robust second half when the confluence of factors come together. So how does that play into your views?
Obviously, the vaccine is probably the single most important factor defining that same internationalization or rotation in portfolios throughout 2021, right? And obviously, we have seen hurdles over the past few weeks. The UK and the US probably have been leading compared to the rest of the world, and that's definitely something that plays against the rotation out of the US and into some of these other markets. I do believe that there will be a catch-up, whether countries like it or not, but that catch-up will very much be a function of how successful those countries that are leading the way are, right? And for that reason, I'm actually quite focused on what's going on in Israel, because Israel this week is going to cross the 50% level, essentially between those that got at least one shot and those that were sick. You're going to break through the 50%, which is, again, the threshold that most discuss as being the herd immunity threshold. And as a result, we're going to be following very quickly and on real time what happens there throughout the next few weeks. And depending on how things evolve, I do believe that countries will start catching up. So it really is more like a few weeks rather than a few months or a few years, right? So that's point number one when it comes to vaccine. Having said all of that, the year will be bumpy. So I do agree with you that there are several hurdles, and actually one of those hurdles are going to be when we start talking about opening up, right? I mean, so let's say if just for example, right? I mean, if we're operating right now at 60 to 70% capacity, right? Most of us working from home and so on and so forth. Even if we move towards 90 to 95% capacity, we're still below capacity, right? We're still running at levels that are below capacity. But the hurdles to get there will start appearing, right? Whether it is, people trying to get back to work, what type of transportation they will be using, and so on and so forth. And we believe that along that way, those hurdles are going to be quite inflationary, pockets of inflation here and there, right? Which is one of the best examples that we're seeing already is world container prices and freight prices, right? I mean, we're already seeing quite a bit of pressures in that front. We are seeing actually oil prices going up quite a bit. So all those things are already starting to appear even before we leave our homes.
Well, that's a perfect segue into inflation, which was my next question for you. You know, the Fed has undershot its inflation target for a decade. We have a big output gap in the United States. There's a difference between a transient supply side increase in inflation versus a more enduring, lasting bump up. This is reflected also in the Fed's new flexible average inflation targeting regime. I don't think economists know much about inflation. You know, if I ask an economist, well, what's causing inflation? I hear about central bank credibility, inflation targeting. I hear about global supply shocks from China. You name it, it's the kitchen sink. So I'm perhaps a bit more muted on this subject. Europe's been in deflation. ECB can't hit its target. Japan's been in deflation more or less for two decades. I find it interesting that market participants are talking so much about inflation. And, you know, for me, the break evens busting above 2% probably has more to do with concerns about being hit by a supply of more treasury paper after when Biden's stimulus plans kick in. I'm perhaps a bit more muted on inflation than you. What's wrong with my worldview?
So we will only know 6 months from now. And the reason is because the narrative over the next 3 months is going to be towards a higher inflation, whether we like it or not. And the reason is just like the so-called base effects, right? Again, the bottom of our prices was, let's say, whatever, 20, throw a number, right? It was so volatile back then. We're now at 60, so it's like a 300% increase year on year. Things like that will start emerging, and the base effects, those same low base effects that we had back in March and April of last year will kick in as we go into the end of the first quarter, early second quarter. And as a result, we are going to see higher headlines. Now, this has an impact on global bond markets through the break-even. So essentially, the break-even has to price that in because people will be paid that inflation, right? Because again, if you buy a tip, again, you get paid that inflation. The headline inflation CPI is something that actually comes out to your pocket if you're holding that paper. And as a result, the price has to basically reflect that. And that gets translated to the entire bond market. So right now, yes, you have that inflation a hurdle that is quite imminent. So let's assume, just to be very extreme, that you peak at 3% or 3.5%, just to make a point, and you are at whatever 1.5% later on down the road. So essentially, you know, the low inflation guys end up winning on the other side. That front end is pushing things a lot higher at the moment. The reason why I do believe that we're not going to drop as dramatically on the other side of this hurdle is because we're going to start seeing uncertainty around the supply side. And there has been supply side destruction that we just don't know of. We don't understand. And there will be outbursts coming as a result of that on the other side of the ledger. So that's as we hit into the late summer and early fall of this year. Now, on top of that, there's a lot of premium in the market. So essentially, you do have, when you go to emerging markets, curves in emerging markets are incredibly steep. I don't believe that many of those emerging market central banks are going to deliver what's in the price. So quite a bit of inflation will actually come from emerging markets. And again, to recall, I'm sure you remember, early 2008, one of the big risks that all the macro guys were looking at was actually higher inflation. Remember, ECB was hiking, actually heading into the global financial crisis. So, and the reason was because there was a lot of inflationary pressures back then coming primarily from China. It was actually all made in China. We had double-digit inflation. So the point is that we have those bottlenecks that will start appearing. And you might be correct in the sense that we might not see that as much coming from Japan and Europe, but we'll be seeing that coming from the emerging world. And as a result, I do see that inflation feeding to the rest of the world. One last point on this. People often tend to dismiss the emerging world, but the nominal GDP pie of emerging markets is growing exponentially faster than the rest of the world. So their importance on generating global inflation is increasing. So I'm talking here second and third derivatives, right? It's much faster than what we believe, and particularly now compared to the global financial crisis.
So in your inflation scenario, though, it sounds as if much of that is supply side driven. And, you know, I think that raises a question about whether the Fed would view that as transient or durable, and how monetary policy might react to that. I mean, it's almost sounds as if you expect inflation to rise sufficiently to compel the Fed to start reining in its accommodation sooner than I think a lot of analysts expect. Is that accurate?
That's the interesting bit, right? And this is where the whole story becomes very convoluted and confusing. Because if you look at just super simple Bloomberg year-end inflation expectations for the United States on PCE, so I'm not even talking about headline, I'm talking about PCE, what the Fed actually targets, right? You will see that basically throughout the entire forecast horizon, there's no way you could actually fill the gap of AID to average 2%, right? So if the beginning of the AIT or average inflation targeting really is January of 2020, for instance, and you aggregate the forecasts, consensus forecast for 2020, 2021, and 2022, you really need to reach 2023 with a headline of 3.5% to justify them hiking in 2024. If you actually take AIT on its word. So my point here is that the market is not pricing in for any of that. The overshoot that is required, and again, it increases every year. There's one point of an overshoot of 2% on PCE, which is imminent, what we talked about earlier in the call, and that's it, right? And then you drop and you basically pursue the rest of the horizon at or below 2%. So again, the point is that it will require a substantial upside surprise, which is something that the Fed will initially accommodate for the reasons we mentioned, the AIT in itself. And as a result, as that happens, we might see some financial stress. And that's probably the next point. So actually, I do see a world where we might see higher inflation that triggers financial stress through higher volatility in markets and the Fed coming in to actually implement some sort of YCC.
You've anticipated my next question, which was kind of on the interaction of fiscal and monetary policy. And, you know, what do you make of the rise in break evens? How do you think the Fed will react if the 10-year rate starts moving up substantially higher? And more generally, how do they feel about global fixed income right now?
So generally speaking, as I mentioned at early point in the call, the desire to be long duration United States is very shallow. And the reason why it's very shallow is because, A, there is all the supply coming up. B, is that there might be more interest in Europe as a result of next gen EU. And last but not least, there are the concerns of around inflation higher in the US that are somewhat, again, more highlighted by markets than they are in Europe and Japan. Right now, by the way, Japan is actually offering probably the highest real yields in the world, right? Because just by osmosis almost, right? So the interesting bit is we do see additional increase in break-evens. We do see the Fed also embracing that as basically this is the policy by design. This is exactly what we want, is to see those break-evens increasing because we are targeting an average inflation target. No. So that's at some point the overshoot would trigger higher implied volatilities across markets. And this is why we're watching very closely for things like MOVE, for instance, which is the option market in fixed income, VIX, implied vols and FX, which are very subdued. As those markets start appearing and showing more stress, we would think that the Fed might come in, right? But we're still very far away from that.
Let's turn to FX. I think this is how we originally met each other a few years ago. So a few weeks ago, markets were bearish on the dollar. I didn't really understand that. Some argue the dollar is relatively high and poised to depreciate structurally. My view, U.S. macro response is more forceful. The ECB will become very accommodative if the dollar falls. Interest differentials, which are a key mover of exchange rates, are already very compressed in the short end. I think if the U.S. outperforms Europe and Japan, that could boost the dollar. I do see the RMB as a good candidate for appreciation, given the current account surplus and some decent capital inflows. I've gotten to the point where I find it's very hard to talk about EM as an asset class or EMFX because you have to look at every country's fundamentals at this point, so variegated. So what do you have to tell us about your team's global FX outlook, and what does your flow data suggest about that?
So we are in the bearish dollar camp, but for different reasons, right? Reason number one, for instance, is what we call recycling of FX reserves. We do see a world where we might start observing FX accumulation around the world. And again, last year, probably India was the most prominent candidate for that. But I wouldn't be surprised all of a sudden FX reserves in China start growing as well, given dollar China downside. And as that starts to take place, we would expect the so-called recycling of FX reserves. So basically, you know, selling of those dollars and then buying, you know, the euro or, you know, Australian dollar, the British pound and so on and so forth. So that's point number one. Point number two is the real interest rates in the U.S. are extraordinarily negative. And with it, actually, almost any type of bond valuation framework will tell you that the U.S. bond market is extraordinarily unattractive at the moment, particularly the sort of the 0 to 10 year sector. I mean, beyond 10 years, a different story, but the 0 to 10 year sector, right? Whether it is issuance, whether it is risk premiums that are embedded in the market and so on and so forth. I'll give you one example. If you look into places like Brazil, places like South Africa, you can gain so much by just riding the carry and roll down in the local curves, as much as 2 to 3 times of what you would be earning in the U.S. In China, which is something that is, again, very unusual, you can basically gain carry by extending duration in your portfolio, which is something that historically has not been the case because the curve in China tends to be very flat. And those things are basically attracting investors to go and be involved in alternative bond markets. And I think this is something, this is here to stay for quite some time. I would say again, three months at least. The moment of truth is going to be during the summer. I do expect that we're going to see significantly more volatility going forward as a result of all those risk premiums spread around bond markets. But this is something that is again, it's a story for the spring.
So we've talked mainly about FX and bond markets, but we haven't really talked about asset markets. And since you just teed up this scenario of low interest rates causing reach for yield around the world, obviously asset markets, equities, et cetera, are one place the flows logically go, in addition. So, how do your investors, feel about global asset markets? We haven't talked about commodities. And do you have anything else to amplify on with regard to the EM space?
So there are two points that I wanted to make. Point number one is the, just a segue to finalize sort of the FX theme, right? Because front-end rates in emerging markets are so low and curves are so steep, a lot of, and this is probably what's very peculiar and unique to this cyclical turn, to almost any cyclical turn that I've seen in the past in my career, and you know, going back to the 1990s, is that it makes sense to hedge your FX exposures. A lot of the flows that are heading into pretty much any market out there, there is a fairly substantial portion of that that ends up being hedged. And we're seeing that, you know, most clearly in Chinese government bonds in the CGB market, where there is buying of bonds, but also hedging the FX. So people are not taking the exposure through the assets that they're buying around the world. They're not taking the FX exposure with it, which is something that is very unique. We haven't really seen this in the past. It's new. So there is a trend. There is definitely a diversification and a rotation trend going on of people trying to switch into alternative markets outside of the United States, as we mentioned at the beginning of the call. But a lot of that is coming across hedged. And it's been very cautious, right? We see there was an outburst after the elections and then it stopped. And then there was another outburst that followed Georgia in the U.S. And that kind of like, you know, stopped. Over the past week or so, we saw a dramatic slowdown on that rotation, primarily on the back of the Lunar New Year, right? That basically Asia is slowing down. A lot of the interest is going into Asia, which is a place where it's particularly attractive to hedge because, again, your local rates are quite low. So all those things are playing into a situation where, yes, investors are buying alternative equities and bond markets, but a lot of that buying is coming with FX hedging.
You've been very generous with your time today. So let me wrap up with the question I frequently ask people. What are the big risks out there that might keep you awake at night that we haven't discussed?
It will be, in our opinion, some variation of a taper tantrum. There will be a moment that, in our opinion, central bankers will embrace inflation in such a way that it might not be taken well by markets, right? Again, for those that were around in April and May of 2013, it was, you know, that same speech out of Bernanke where basically he discussed and he raised the tapering idea. I definitely don't think that he meant to trigger the kind of volatility that ended up being realized in the subsequent weeks. And I think that we will be seeing situations similar to that, where essentially there is a miscommunication because there is so much handholding that the Federal Reserve or other central banks for that matter can have with the markets. And as a result, we might see a very significant bear steepening that causes financial stress. That's essentially where we're coming from. And I think that, this is definitely a theme for the spring of this year.
You know, whether miscommunication or not, ultimately the ship will turn, and that in and of itself could produce eruptions no matter how well communicated or not. But it's interesting to hear you put a spring timeline on that. That's much earlier than most, and it's in a way earlier than some of the regional Fed presidents I mentioned earlier, although they were just saying it was something that later on in the year would have to be on radar screens. So that's definitely a very interesting comment.
I am an emerging markets guy. I grew up in Brazil, right? So I'm, I've seen inflation firsthand. And the one experience that I have from inflation is that you react to it when you feel it. And so if indeed we see inflation materializing, people will be reacting to it after the fact. So, and that's why, you know, there's so much talk about adaptive expectations when it comes to inflation, because there is an element of past history that ends up having an impact on agents' behavior going forward.
Well, great. Well, I thank you for joining us. We should let you get back to your day job, but this has been a fascinating conversation, very valuable. We've all learned tremendously from you. Thank you, Daniel Tannengauser.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF Podcast.